time goes on, do you feel like it's more or less likely Pete Alonso's Met? What do you think?
More likely. Okay. Lauren, at this stage, I would be surprised if Pete Alonso does not ultimately sign with the New York Mets. And here's why. There was a report this morning from Jim Duquette, the former Mets GM, that Alonso's camp has offered to the Mets a three-year deal with opt-outs after the first and second year. This is a very common construct of a contract for a Scott Boras client if the full market isn't typically there. We saw a similar structure for Carlos Correa, a similar structure for Cody Bellinger. Here, of course, is where Alonso ranks, and if he stays there, he's going to be the best home run hitter in Mets history. But let's take a step back here. The 2023 season, our colleague Joel Sherman reported that at that point in time, the Mets had offered Alonso a seven-year deal worth $158 million. That was during the 2023 season, at which point in time Alonso rejected it. Now, that was before David Stearns became the Mets GM, so that it's a different GM, same owner, but a different GM. And at the time, Alonso's camp said no to 7 years, 158, according to Joel's reporting. Now, what Jim Duquette is saying is that Alonso's camp has said to the Mets, we would accept a three-year deal, one assumes at a pretty high AAV, but still a three-year deal with opt-outs, and that they have offered this back to the Mets. Lauren, at this point in time, I'd be surprised if this does not ultimately lead to an agreement for Alonso with the Mets. If he's willing to take a three-year deal at this stage, that feels like we're getting close to an agreement in my estimation, because if there is no longer-term deal out there somewhere else from a team like the Giants, for example, or the Angels, the best short-term deal would be for him to stay with the Mets. And then you've got Vientos playing third base. You've got good production for Juan Soto. Lauren, at this stage, I don't see a better outcome for Pete Alonso. If he's willing to take the short-term deal, based on what Jim Duquette's reported, this sure seems like a likely result at this stage of the game.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, January the 12th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, Talking Mets, no G. And I'd love for you to subscribe to the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast here. A snowy, cold, hot stove edition of the show. And I know you're tired of the hot stove. I am too. And just like we were really tired of the Juan Soto talk, and by the time he signed at the beginning of the winter meetings, we were at the point where we were ready to say, enough. I think we're like that with Pete Alonso. I think we're like that with the hot stove. And I know that there's a lot of concerns out there by Mets fans. What's David Stearns doing? Why is it taking so long? Why is he sitting back while others are falling off the board? Whether it be Roky Sasaki, who it seems more and more likely will be going to the Dodgers, is holding things up. Is it Pete Alonso holding things up? Whatever. Whatever's holding things up. Things are as slow can be. Spring training is just a little over a month away with pitchers and catchers reporting. Before you know it, in about 6 weeks or less, there'll be spring training games. And you're less than 2 months away, or about 2 months away, well, actually less, from opening day. So, you know, well, a little bit more than 2 months, I should say. So, anyway. All that being said, big show here for you today. Couple of topics. In the first half of the show, I really want to have an honest conversation about Pete Alonso, because this is about as a tricky spot that both sides are in. So I could see as this thing continues to develop, as his market develops, as the Mets roster crystallizes, as some things that are down the pike when it comes to payroll and the collective bargaining agreement could come into play, I could understand where this decision is not easy as anything. I could understand the Mets' position. I understand that Alonso's position is that this might be his only shot to get a big deal. So I get both sides. But both sides, especially Alonso, are at a very interesting crossroads. So we're going to take that tack today when it comes to talking about free agency and Alonso. And then the bullpen, I know everybody's getting excited. Will Salmon at The Athletic reported, and Andy Martino as well, that the Mets are starting to look at the top end of the bullpen. Maybe Tanner Scott, one of the best arms out there, is available. The Mets, as I've talked about for a while, are going to need another closer to supplement Diaz, maybe sub in for Diaz, maybe split with Diaz. There's a lot of nuance there to Diaz. I'm not sure Scott is either realistic or the right option. I'll get into the bullpen and the 40-man roster. And, of course, we'll wrap up by talking about what's left to talk about this January Hall of Fame show next week. We'll get into the Hall of Fame and the Talking Mets ballot. So chock full of stuff that we have to get into. So let's start with Pete Alonso. So we're now at the point where it's the blank or get off the pots portion of the offseason. Boris has dragged this out. Boris has tried to, as he always does, get Alonso a long-term deal. There were reports earlier in the week, and when you started to hear this, you thought this was about to go bad, that Boris was putting Prince Fielder comp 9 years, $213 million, in front of, I guess, Alonso as where he thought his benchmark would be. We've heard Mark Teixeira's contract back in 2008. These are very dated contracts. These are different economic times for baseball. And as pointed out since then, not sure how relevant they are, but when Pete turned down with his prior agency a 7-year extension, as reported by Joel Sherman, and hired Boris at the end of 2023, you know he was taking his best shot at getting a big deal. I mean, he saw what Boris did for Brandon Nimmo. Obviously, Boris did a great job with Soto. He's able to get maximum value for players, and that's all Pete wanted. You know, knowing how, as he started at age 24, he started a little bit later than maybe some other elite players entering his age 30 season. This might be his last and only shot for a really big contract, depending on how it goes. So I understand all that. I think, and the guys over at Mets Fix made a great point with the CBA coming up in a couple of years. And there was actually a graph earlier today that showed, I think John Heyman pointed out, the Mets are actually like down like $77 million in terms of spending since the end of last year. I'm trying to bring it up over here. Yeah, here it is. The Mets actually have taken off the most amount of payroll to date, about $77 million. And now that's going to change. That's going to change. Whereas teams like Philadelphia and Baltimore and Detroit and San Diego, and obviously the Dodgers, not much by the Dodgers, have gone up or stayed the same. So the Mets are very cognizant of how unsustainable, even with Steve Cohen as their owner, that their payroll was the last couple of years. And I think David Stearns, and part of what he's been hired to do, is to complement big spending where it makes sense, like Soto, with responsible spending and improving the roster around the margins. So this is where it gets tricky, because as we enter the offseason, it was clear they needed to at least bring back a similar type of rotation, maybe improve it. Spending at the top end of the starting rotation was not something that I thought they'd have an appetite for, nor was I an advocate for. I would have liked them to get more certainty into the bullpen. They still haven't done that. That's a conversation in the back half of the show. Helping Diaz out. Rely less, de-emphasize to a certain degree. There'll always be an emphasis on the fungible parts of the bullpen, but get some kind of veteran, hopefully a guarantee in terms of what they can produce. Hopefully they stay healthy and provide a better bridge to Diaz, as I thought guys like Stanek and Maton were more sixth and seventh inning guys. Reed Garrett, I thought those guys were more sixth and seventh inning guys. They were put into roles where they were asked to get big outs, high leverage outs in the eighth inning or sub in as a closer. I didn't really feel comfortable about that all year. I think it puts a lot of pressure on Diaz to be overused at times, and I think there's a feast or famine scenario to Diaz utilization. So there's that. And I also am not so sure Diaz is a guy that could get more than three outs. I think that's an honest conversation, something that we might want to look a little bit more into as spring training gets closer. Now, the real piece was, okay, they went out and they won the Derby. They won the Soto Derby. And immediately that improves their offense. But it's not enough. You have an offense right now without a first baseman, without a designated hitter. You have Vientos at third. You have, obviously, Lindor, your MVP candidate at short. You have McNeil at second. You have, your outfield still status quo. You got your defensive center fielder in Siri. You've got Nimmo as your left fielder. So you still are a couple of bats short right now. You're a couple of bats short. And the Mets made a promise to Soto that they would land a couple of, you know, at least another bat to pair him in there. They're not going to land them with Aaron Judge. There's no Aaron Judge right now that they could pair him with. That's an elite top. I mean, that's just like Soto. That's a rare commodity. That's a top 10 offensive player all time, going back to the days of Babe Ruth. They don't grow on trees. Now, there's been some rumors, and they're more internet-based rumors, and I'm not so sure that I believe that the Mets will go this route. But it's possible. You never know. Look, nobody knew they were going to sign Correa in the middle of the night. But there's a rumor that they have a big short-term AAV offer to Bregman. And you've heard the rumor, more substantiated rumor, that there's a big short-term AAV offer to Alonso. I'm not going to get into the whole Bregman thing. I think it would be awesome on a short-term deal to get both Alonso and Bregman. I think there's risk in both of them. If you ask me to choose, I'd rather go with Alonso because of the power and because I think there's more concerning components to Bregman than there is to Alonso, if you believe it, as much as I like the glove at third. And then, you know, maybe you fill out around the margins with the Jesse Winkers and things like that, component-driven. You still have some of the kids that, like the Mauricios of the world and the Drew Gilberts that could maybe contribute on the offensive side. And then you go out and you get yourself a bullpen arm, which we'll talk about later. So I really don't want to get too into both, but really right now, and this is, and I wrote about this over at Beyond the Mic, it's an inconvenient marriage. Maybe Pete doesn't like the fact that because it's been reported the Mets are the only team he's willing to give that short, high AAV, shorter term deal. Maybe that's just, hey, I'll do it because of the Mets, because let's remember, and Pete owes the Mets nothing. The Mets didn't hold him back the 2 weeks back in 2019 to get another year of control. So they actually did him from, and what's the right thing to do, I thought was a good message to send to the organization and the roster when Brody Van Wagenen took over, even though it didn't make sense from managing the payroll and the CBA. I thought he earned the role in spring training by having a big spring, and he jumped out and got off to a big start out of the gate. So Pete earned it, and I thought that was the right thing to do. Not that Pete should reward the Mets for that, because he earned that, but remember, they've never really steered Pete wrong. They've never steered Pete wrong from the day one. They've always been patient with him. I think the fans have been patient with him, despite the fact that I think the last 2 years, there's been serious deficiencies in his offensive game, and I think there's deficiencies on his defensive game at times. Those are clear, but I think overall, everybody in the Mets community, from ownership to the front office, to the fans, they've been good to Pete. So giving that opportunity for the Mets to get the advantage over whoever else is out there, who it sounds like there's no other long-term deals, but if he was going to sign with Seattle or San Francisco or Toronto, whatever other team gets thrown out there, it's not going to be for a three-year short AAV deal, unless the Mets say, hey, we're out, we're not interested. So, you know, that's part of it there. I think that's the inconvenient part of the marriage on the Alonso side. The inconvenient part on the Mets side is they really don't have a better choice right now in terms of an impact bat. They really don't. You have Santander out there who apparently is falling into the same category as short-term deal. As a matter of fact, all these risky free agents, as the offseason goes on, guys like Jack Flaherty, Santander, Pete, even Bregman, guys that you can make arguments that those contracts could go really bad, really quick, and lop up your payroll and cause you, especially if you're a big market team, some really gnarly tax bills that could prevent you from having flexibility to improve your roster in the future, they're all falling into the same sphere. It's almost like that's what these off seasons go about. The players that have the leverage to get the long-term deal, they get their bag first. And then there's the lull for the holidays. And then everybody else who really would like to get their bag, but they're just not, for a variety of reasons, going to get it. Now they have to figure out what is the acceptable landing space. And they have to play this out until, you know, 30 days less to pitchers and catchers. And it really blocks the rest of the market, all the component players and bullpen arms. And it's really a dynamic that's made the offseason tedious and, I'm sure, nerve-wracking for even the players who don't know where they're going to be. And they'd love to know their report. You know, obviously, they'd love to know their report date. So Pete's falling into that. And the Mets right now, if they don't sign Pete Alonso, yeah, you have Santander. Yeah, you have Bregman. But I think there's real questions then to do they have enough offense? I mean, with Soto, they nearly are, if you look at just some projections and whatnot, they're averaging a shade under 5 runs a game. But that's just projections. That's assuming you have a big year from Lindor. There's no injuries. You get similar type of production up and down the lineup. And let's face it, there's some big questions. There's health questions with Brandon Nimmo. You don't have a DH. I mean, are you going to go component-driven with your DH? And in center field, you have a great defensive center fielder in Siri, but he can't hit. I mean, he's probably worse than Harrison Bader. So there's some big questions. There's questions in the rotation. Can they repeat how good they were down the stretch? And obviously these questions in the bullpen will be answered. They'll fill out the roster, I think, acceptably. But they'll look very similar to the 2024 club with Soto going into the season. And I don't think that's what Mets fans wanted after the great run they had in October. Now, as Zach Scott, former Mets GM, said on SNY earlier in the week, and this really rings true for every single team with the modern GM, and it doesn't align with the marketing of to the fans, to the fans feeling good about their team from day one onward, but you don't have to have a championship roster on opening day. You have to have a team that's competitive, because ultimately, even if you win 95 games, you don't go through the season from starting gate to end, wire to wire, very often without any pain. What happened in 2006, where the Mets were good from the jump, that doesn't usually happen. What happened in 1986 from the jump doesn't usually happen. Now, you also don't want to have another scenario like you had in 2024, and I think there was some extreme factors that played into this when it happened, was that you don't want a scenario where the team is double digits under 500 and has to make this huge run to make the playoffs and play basically 86 Mets level baseball from, you know, June 1st to the end of the year. That's very hard to sustain. That's very hard to sustain. Everything, a lot of stuff has to go right. And again, I always say teams wind up where they are. If you're an 89-win team, whether you start out under 500 or start out playing 650 baseball, you're going to win 89 games. Look at the Phillies. They played tremendous baseball the first half. They leveled out in the second half. That's how baseball works. But it's not comfortable for fans to know that their front office, their wealthy owner, their GM, their elite GM that so did the industry looks at, is willing to go into the season and play fast and loose with what we call here at the Talking Mets podcast, the getting to know you phase, the first 60 or so games. But it is something they're going to do. They're going to do it in some manner. They're probably going to do it in the rotation. I think they're done with the rotation. They may do it with some parts of the bullpen, maybe not to the extent they did in 24. You can't do this to me, guys. You can't do this in the offense. And I don't think they will. They're going to sign another quality bat, unless things go wonky here. But here's the real rub. The only pathway where this makes sense for the Mets, as the more I look at it, the more I'm honest about it, and I love the Pete home run, and no matter what happens, Pete will go down in history as a beloved Met, even if he never plays another game. That home run in Milwaukee cemented that, even though it probably didn't have to have that. You know, it at least gave you a good taste in your mouth on the way out. How he played against the Dodgers and the Phillies, although he wasn't elite, it wasn't like he went out there and he had, you know, an MVP series, but he had big home runs against the Phillies. He had a big home run in Game 5 against the Dodgers, which got the Mets going. So you know he can perform on the big stage. So Pete's always going to be beloved. And if he stays here for another couple of years and sets the Mets home run record, that's going to be a record that's going to stand for a while, because power that Pete provides does not grow on trees, especially in the span of time, the amount of home runs he's hit in a span of about 6 years. Okay? So let's put it that way. But because of history, and not just long-term contracts, similar type of players that were like Pete, corner infielders, right-handed batters, shoot, left-handed batters, that enter the age of 30 and north, they show a precipitous decline. Now, this is why the Mets are playing hardball. This is why Pete's probably frustrated, because what you see out of a Paul Goldschmidt, and, you know, even to a certain degree, not the same position, how Mike Piazza was pretty effective even into his mid-30s, that's not common. That's not common. I mean, a guy like Piazza was effective till the age of 33, 34. He started to suffer some injuries after the age of 34, and he played a much more demanding position, but that's not common. When you look at Pete Alonso and you look at where he is now and you go to Baseball Reference and you just say, okay, what are some similar players through the age of 39? Here are the names that come up. Names that make you smile, but all have some kind of cautionary tale tied to it. Mark McGwire, Chris Davis, Cecil Fielder, Richie Sexson. You might not know this name. He's from the 80s. Big power-hitting right-handed first baseman for the Astros. Glenn Davis, Ryan Howard. I'm just throwing some names out. There's more. I mean, you also have guys like Jim Gentile, Dick Stewart, you know, Rhys Hoskins, and things like that. You know, everybody has something here to offer. But these are really, really good comps. And if you go to Baseball Reference after the show, and I'll give you some examples, and I think one of the best examples, and I've brought this up before, a guy that to me is a very similar type of player to Alonso, right-handed bat, is Richie Sexson. And Richie Sexson's a guy that in 2004 signed a big contract with Seattle. And most of that contract was dead money, especially when it became expensive. And here's the thing. Richie Sexson, from when he became a full-time player with Cleveland in 1999 till about 2005, his first year in Seattle, he had an OPS plus of 127, an 880 OPS, hit on average would hit about 33 home runs, driving 100 runs a season. At that point, he had for his career 228 home runs. You know, a span of time somewhat similar to Pete. He, you know, goes to Seattle, signs the contract. Like Pete, struck out a ton at times. Was a little bit better of a on-base walk guy. But average-wise, was a guy that at best would hit 260, 270. Usually would be in the 230 to 250 range. After that 2005 season, where he was actually getting MVP votes, and he hit 39 home runs, drove in 121 runs, Seattle signs into this deal. They're feeling good, especially in that ballpark. He, you know, following year, he still hits 34 home runs, drives in 107 runs, but he's now got his one of his lower OPSs since earlier in his career, and he's an OPS plus of 117. By age 32, he was a below league average player. By age 33, 34, he's out of the league. Yankees get him off the scrap heap. He doesn't even fulfill his contract with Seattle in any way, shape, or form. And he's out of the league. Chris Davis, Baltimore. Now, that's a real cautionary tale. Everybody brings him up. Everybody knows he signs the big contract with the Orioles. Okay? And the Orioles have paid him until 2022. They were on the hook. He signed the contract in 2016 when he hit the age of 30. At that point, he drops like a rock. Age 31, OPS plus below league average, 215 average, 195 strikeouts, hit a .168. Yes, a .168 at age 32. He was done. He produced nothing. Now, that's the extreme example. You want to go back to the 1960s? He's a lefty power hitter, big power hitter. Jim Gentile for the Orioles. A guy that would hit, you know, in 1961, everybody talks about Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle. This guy hit 46 home runs. This guy was hitting 30 home runs in an era where it wasn't an offensive era. There wasn't a juice ball. There wasn't expansion yet all the time. There wasn't what you see today with smaller ballparks, so to speak, all the time. Here's a guy that after the age of 30, you know, he hits 28 home runs for Kansas City at the age of 30, OPS plus of 128, 837 OPS, you know, guy that walks. I mean, he falls off the cliff at age 31, doesn't hit 20 home runs again for the rest of his career, out of the league by age 32. Out of the league, age 32, age 33. That's reality. I mean, this is what happens to big power hitters as they hit the age of 32. And you're still not convinced? Well, you ever hear of a guy named Cecil Fielder? Cecil Fielder. When the Yankees got him, you know, just a couple of years earlier, he had hit, 35 home runs, 30 home runs. This is a guy that hit, you know, 40 and 50 home runs when he came back to the States after his stint in Japan for the Tigers. Yankees got him at age 32. He was a good component player, but, you know, he was out of the league by age 34. He was a little above league average. I mean, McGuire, you don't want to get into that because you know what, but McGuire, when he hit 30, before he started taking steroids, and part of what McGuire's issue was injuries, McGuire was declining by age 30. McGuire was on the way out of the league. Ryan Howard started his career late, like Alonso, and he had that injury to his Achilles that, you know, everybody can remember if you watched that last out in the postseason in Game 5 of the NLDS, where Howard crumples to the ground on a ground ball. And Howard comes back the following year. He was really never the same again. He was never the same again after that injury. And that was age 31. He was a below league average player. So more than likely, and I've given you so many examples here, and you could go on Baseball Reference and look it up. More than likely, that's the ghost of Christmas future for Pete Alonso, if history repeats itself. And I've given you so many. I mean, you could even look at a Hall of Famer. You know, you want to talk about steroids? Fine, I get it. But Jeff Bagwell's career, I mean, he lasted till the age of 35, 36. But again, there's probably, you know, rumored PED use. But he fell off the rock in his late 30s. That would be more of a cautionary tale with a long-term deal. You know, you're just talking age 32. That's getting a value out of a three-year deal for Pete Alonso. And really, here's the thing. This is why this is a little bit of a chess game for Alonso. You want to hold out. You want to get a long-term deal. You want to see as you get closer to spring training if somebody gets desperate enough to say, you know what, I'll give you a seven-year deal, $25 million per. You know, I'll give you that deal. That'll exceed the total dollar value of the 3 years. Who knows if the Mets have deferrals? Maybe there's no deferrals in that. Team sees him as he gets closer. He does something like I wrote about over at Beyond the Mic, like Steven Drew waits till spring training, which I think would be very risky for Pete. I think the longer he waits into, you know, Valentine's Day, the less likely he's going to get a long-term deal. He might have to settle. And then he gets his contract. Then he's signed through age 37, and it's a moot point because he gets paid no matter what he does. See, here Pete is taking the risk and saying, okay, I need to show the world. I need to show the league. And, you know, maybe he could even get a situation where Soto helps him, that I'm more the player that I was in 2022, where I hit 270. I hit 40 home runs. I drove 130 runs. I had an OPS plus of 146. I made the All-Star team. I finished in top 10 in the MVP. I was able to show a knack of not striking out 150, 160, 170 times, go the other way, drive in runs, not be so prone to the off-speed pitch. That's the Pete at that point that I said, okay, after 2022, that's a guy, you know, Aaron Judge got the big contract, and rightfully so, I got scorched. That's the guy that I said might get a 10-year deal worth $300 million. Now, I didn't even think, and this has been brought up by the Will Salmons of the world and the guys that have been reporting this stuff, if he gets a three-year deal for about $33 million per, he blows away Freddie Freeman's AAV. I wasn't even thinking of Miguel Cabrera, who I think has the record, because I looked at him more as a DH, but he, you know, he made $31 million a year. I mean, here's a guy that won the Triple Crown. Here's a guy that won the MVP. Here's a guy that's a first ballot Hall of Famer in 2028. I mean, if he doesn't get in, I mean, he should be unanimous, but you know how that goes. But even at age 32, age 33, he started to decline. From age 34 on, he was a below league average hitter, a great Hall of Fame hitter. He hung on. He was still valuable. He still had use. I mean, the Tigers had no choice. They had to pay him. I mean, they were paying him until the age of 40. I mean, what you see out of Cabrera, you might start to see out of Soto at some point. That might be a primer of how the Soto contract goes. But if he gives you Hall of Fame and MVP and you win a World Series or you win a couple pennants and he goes into the Hall of Fame as a Met, you know, and he's still useful, even though he's overpaid later in his career, he's still useful, then, you know, yeah, it's worth it. You really don't want two of those guys on your team. Right now, Soto is the guy they invested in. Pete's not Soto. You could say Soto is not a great base runner, but he's got a good arm. Maybe he's not a great in range in the outfield, but I don't think he's going to be Glenn Allen Hill, and for those who don't know that reference, go look that up. But he's an elite hitter. Like I said, top 10 hitter in the history of baseball going into this year. They do not grow on trees. They do not grow on trees. So Pete goes in, signs a short-term deal. For the Mets, it'd be nice to get 2 years before the opt-out. But even if they get 1 year for the opt-out, here's the other interesting part of all this. And everybody keeps talking about Vlad Guerrero Jr. Now, there's another guy who's probably going to get a 10-year deal, who's going to be looking to be in the same world as Soto. There's a guy with a bad body. That's not like his father. He's not this lanky, athletic guy like his father. He's a big boy. He's a lot like Prince Fielder. He's going to get a big contract. Everyone says, well, you keep the flexibility for Vlad Guerrero next year on the free agent market. You know, maybe. Maybe the Mets say, look, I'll take the risk. I'll pair Soto and Guerrero, these two elite hitters. And Guerrero could either DH or play first base, whatever. And that's how they're going to be their foundation. At some point, and this is where the guys at Mets Fix were really smart. They were talking about the CBA. With the collective bargaining agreement coming up in a couple of years, you don't know what the tax situation is going to look like. If they go NBA route, and even if they don't do a salary cap, they make it very punitive for teams. And here's what the NBA does. They make it where they affect your roster movement or your ability to improve your roster if you hit certain tax thresholds. So even if you want to pay the tax in the NBA, look at where the Knicks are at. You don't necessarily have the flexibility to make moves to improve your roster. And then you could have a situation where you have a top-heavy team and you're looking around for all these trash or treasure jewels to round out your roster. Then you have the 2008-2007 Mets. And that's how, you know, you could say, okay, now I need to figure out where am I going to invest with my big hitters? I can't invest in four or five big hitters. I need to invest in a couple. I got to make sure if they're going to have high AAVs that I could surround these guys with something. That's a possibility. Now, that's a whole other story because, you know, 30 years ago, they tried to destroy the sport by taking a hard line on a salary cap. I find it hard to believe that the owners have the gumption to do it, but there are enough hawks in this group that may. So you also, have, as an owner, as Cohen and Stearns, you may look at this and say, look, I got to make sure in 3 years, I'm not one of those teams that on a new CBA looks like an inflexible, bloated payroll that I can't do anything with, and I just have to round my roster out like a small market team because I can't because of the rules. That is not, I'm not saying that's a high probability of happening, but I think a component of that could. So all of this right now puts the next couple of years and how the Mets go long-term with players and makes it really important. And Pete is at that point. So this could be an inconvenient marriage. Pete doesn't want a short-term deal. He wants probably to get a 7-year deal. He probably wants the Mets to show more faith and more love in him. But history, and I gave you all the names, lefty, righty, all the names over there. You know, yeah, you could say, well, Mike, you know, you got Paul Goldschmidt and you have Bagwell and Mark McGwire went into their late 30s. I mean, that's a whole other thing, the 90s guys. You have to be careful there. you know, yeah, Goldschmidt, you know, you look at Goldschmidt. Goldschmidt, you know, he declined last year. The Yankees are looking for a bounce back. Goldschmidt was an elite player to the age of 34. But look, Pete's 30 next year. So you really, even with the Goldschmidt as a comp, you don't want to go more than 4 years. I was always comfortable with 4 or 5 years, knowing that year five was going to be, I don't know. He sets the record for Mets home runs. Maybe the Mets win a couple pennants. Maybe the Mets win a championship. Pete goes down as a beloved Met. The fans want him back. It's funny because it would have been real interesting if he dropped that pop-up, if they lost game three because it led to more runs and the game got out of hand. It'd be interesting how the fans would look at Pete if his Mets career ended with that drop pop-up in Milwaukee without the go-ahead home run in the ninth. We won't know. It doesn't matter right now. What I do know is that history is against Alonso being effective more than the next 2 or 3 years. I think Alonso has to prove himself. And maybe there will be teams that see him. If he comes back looking like a demon, and he's out there, and he hits 45 home runs, and he looks like the Pete from 2022, and he and Soto do the best copy of what Judge and Soto did a year ago, then you know what? He opts out, all bets are off. And if I'm the Mets, I still say, I'm not so sure I want to commit long term. Remember, I haven't even thrown the fact that we don't know what Lindor will look like late in his deal. You know, the Mets have three of these guys in their mid-30s, late-30s that are not the same level of player. Now, there's always rookies, there's always kids, there's always guys that come up and they push these guys to the component part of their roster and they become the hub. When Wright and Reyes came up, Piazza was declining and on the way out. So they became the focus. When Wright was starting to decline, you had Cespedes, you had Granderson, you had Duda, you had some other guys that were able to pick up the slack as his body was giving away. So what happens? Pete and McNeil came up as the year after Wright retired. So there's always that rite of passage that goes on. But it's a game. It's a chess match. And you know, I think David Stearns is correct and the Mets and Cohen are correct. And I know fans, well, Cohen's rich. He could afford it. You don't stay rich and you don't become rich by being foolish with long-term investments. You know? So that's kind of where I'm at. So that's the crossroads for Pete and the Mets. Pete's at a crossroads. And this year is a huge year for Pete, whether he's in a Mets uniform or not. Because I don't think he's getting a long-term deal. He's getting a short-term deal with opt-outs. I ultimately think the Mets will sign him. Whether they sign him and Bregman, that's a whole other thing. I don't want to speculate. Because that Bregman-Pete rumor is really down the Twitter internet rabbit hole. But, you know, we'll leave it at that. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, fans are getting all jazzed up about Tanner Scott. I even see them say, again, just spend the money. Bring Tanner Scott in. 4 years, $80 million. Give him $20 million a year. Calm down. Let's look at the Mets bullpen, and we'll kind of go and give an off-season update. We already know where they're at with the offense, and we're waiting for Pete Alonso. Who knows? As I'm on the air here, maybe something comes down, and I got to trash the whole thing and start over. So anyway, let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more right after this.